It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting this morning's show. And if you heard the feeder into our show, you heard Mike Causey talking about the last Friday in July being a slow news day. Well, not if you're in the SES. It is not a slow news day. Congress has been working very diligently for the last few months to build up to this day. And what better day than last Friday in July with the news that approaches us? We're going to spend our whole show talking about it, talking about the SES, the state of the SES today in the federal government and SES reform. So we have with us today to talk about that the people you'd expect to hear from. We have Carol Bonacero, who is the president of the Senior Executive Association. Carol, good morning.
Good morning.
We have Jenny Mattingly. She's the legislative director for the Senior Executive Association. She's going to tell us what Congress is up to. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning.
And we are very pleased to have with us Jeff Neal, a very well-known name in the federal system. Jeff is currently the Senior Vice President for ICF International. He's the publisher of the ChiefHRO.com blog. Great blog, Jeff. But most importantly, he's here today because he's the former Chico for the Department of Homeland Security. Welcome to our show, Jeff.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
We have interesting topics to talk about. We have people who are clearly in the know. And for those of you who need the primer on the Senior Executive Service to understand what Congress is proposing today to make quote-unquote changes and reforms to improve it, I think it's good to know where the SES came from. Senior Executive Service was created in 1978. And Carol, I've heard you explain this to people many times, and I think you do a great job of telling people where it came from and why.
Well, interestingly enough, and I hate to think of the number of years ago, but I was there, so... actually, the primary driver of creating the SES, there were a number of drivers, but a very big one was the fact that up until the creation of the SES, we had so-called supergrades, GS 16, 17, 18, and political leadership could not move those folks, could not move us where they thought we might be best needed. And so there had to be a way to accomplish that. What's interesting as you look back at the creation of the SES is that there was a very extensive period, a lot of thought, a lot of effort went into crafting the proposal. I know Dwight Inc. talks about his experience doing that periodically. And so when this went to Congress and when it was ultimately adopted, it was a very carefully crafted system of risk and reward. Because clearly there had to be a way to entice all of these supergrades to move into the SES. And so the rewards were going to be substantial, and at least in our view at that time, there would be performance awards, presidential rank awards, unlimited annual leave, sabbaticals. Well, no one knows what that is. there have been so few. But it worked, and people moved in. And... it also
people moved in with great pride and honor.
Absolutely, because we said we're up to this.
It was the pinnacle of people's career.
We would be delighted to do that. So, and besides, if you didn't move in, essentially the view was you'll probably be left in the Siberia, the what remains in the GS supergrades. So it, of course, over the years that ratio, that balance of risk to reward has shifted. And I think the sad thing today is we're not looking at the system, or at least Congress is not looking at the system as a whole, but taking pokes at pieces of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they've got legislation that they've just proposed this week that feels like it's getting rather comprehensive. Then there was subsequent quote unquote reform to the SES in 2004. It was the reform to the pay system.
Yeah, in which case the ranks ES 1 through 6 were abolished and replaced by a very broad pay band, which went down inexplicably way too low. And the unfortunate part about that was that it was adopted. Well, it was proposed by the Bush administration, which refused to talk about anything, any part of it, to consider any changes and whether all of it made sense or not. And ultimately adopted by the Congress without any hearings. So we lost locality pay, yeah. Which I think is was a real and remains a real problem, yeah. For example.
And Jeffrey, you and I have had several conversations whenever we meet about these issues, including what, you know, to me is one of the real issues, which no one will talk about. No one who controls either branch of government will talk about this issue. And when you talk about SES reform, what has clearly been in need of reform is a fix to the 2004 pay compression. And I know that you've given that a lot of thought.
Well, the 2004 bill was touted as a reform, but it wasn't a reform. As Carol said, it got rid of locality pay, which most people agree makes sense to pay people a little bit differently based on where they are. It, for some reason, took the bottom end of the SES pay down to $120,000 a year, which might sound like a lot of money to somebody making $50,000 or $60,000 a year, but it's less than a lot of GS-14s make. So we end up with a system where we take away the locality pay, we make it a so-called pay-for-performance system, but if you give anybody a big pay raise, then you get criticized for giving them a big pay raise. So it's really a low pay-for-performance system. You make the bottom end of the pay range so low that it doesn't attract anybody to the SES. And then we got rid of the pay levels. There used to be 6 pay levels in SES. Got rid of those and had one big pay range. And then what did some agencies do? DOD and the intelligence community went out and tiered, they called it, their SESs. Now they have SES level 1, level 2, and level 3, with level 3 being the highest. I was in DOD when they came up with that, and I opposed it strongly. I thought it was a silly idea. I still think it's a silly idea. And so I suggested to them that since they were going to have 3 pay levels, they should call them GS-16, 17, and 18, because that's about what they did, is they went back to super grades. I'm actually working on a blog post called Everything Old is New Again, where I'm talking about a lot of these ideas that are warmed over ideas from years ago that mm-hmm. were not particularly good ideas when mm-hmm. when they first came up, and they're even worse ideas now.
Well, you know, the reason I think that they went to the tiers, especially in DOD, is it just critical. I mean, you've got military ranks. You had to have some equivalent. And I know years ago, and we still have the chart, they had a wonderful chart of ES 1 through 6 and what military ranks they equated to and what privileges they granted. So for them, it seemed as though it was just, you know, like lemmings to the sea. We've got to have some way of expressing rank.
So they wanted to deal with the protocol issue. And in dealing with the protocol issue, they went right back to the pre-SES problem of we can't move these people around. Yep. If I'm a Tier 3 SES and you desperately need me in a Tier 1 job, I'm going to say, I don't want that job. That's a 2-level demotion. Where if they had just left them alone, they could have moved them wherever they wanted to.
So for me, what's really interesting about, because I've heard Jeff tell this story several times now, and it's always so fascinating for me to hear the story. And I always have a slightly different perspective when I hear it from you. And so for me today, what I hear is, here was civil service reform, and when it was implemented, the military personnel drove a correction, a modification to how the system was supposed to work. Because as I understand from talking to people inside DOD, it wasn't that the career SES wanted to know their equivalent. It was when the military rank walked into the room, they wanted to know who their equivalent was, which is not, you know, that status-driven system is not necessarily how the civil service works.
Well, and that's why we had, and I, at the time, it baffled me. Many years ago, a board member on Senior Executive Association said, we need an SES flag. And I thought, what in the world? What is he? Why would we need that? But fortunately, he had the flag design. We created it. And we are still selling flags to these days because it is a walk into an SES office and you know the person's rank. And in DOD, which was the primary customer initially, that was critical.
I still have my SES flag from DLA when I got to DLA. They gave me an SES flag and I still have it at home.
You're a flag officer. We need to take our first break. I'm not done talking about the problems and the issues with the 2004 reform, because I want to finish that. No one's talking about that, and no one's talking about it because they've decided SESers, I'm going to steal Carol's thunder, are great pinatas to whack around. But I think talking about the pay issue is still very important. Someone should talk about it, should be us. We're going to take our first break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting this morning's show. We're here talking about the Senior Executive Service in the last Friday of July, along with Carol Bonacero, the president of the Senior Executive Association, Jenny Mattingly, who's the legislative director for SEA, and Jeff Neal, who is the former Chico at DHS and is the publisher of a fantastic blog, chiefhro.com. Before we took our break, we were talking about the 2000 reform and what it produced, whatever we are now, 10 years later, a decade later, which for people who actually do care about the SES and the work that the career senior executives do. And I also want to ask you, Jeffrey, why we should care about that work. To us, that's one of the most broken parts of the system in need of a fix, but not while we have the political atmosphere of what we have. But we were talking, Jeff, before we took the commercial break, we were talking about how it sort of originated, what did DOD do with it, and I want to get back to that with you.
Well, DOD did have this protocol question they felt like they needed to deal with. But they also thought they needed some way of differentiating SESs so they could decide, you know, is this job worth more money than another job? And I didn't think that was a discussion worth having, frankly, because there was so little difference in the top end of those tiers. You know, if the difference between the top end of a tier three and a tier two is $7,000 or $8,000. I mean, are people really going to change their behavior? People who are making $170,000 a year, are they going to change their behavior to be able to make $177,000? Are they going to perform differently? Are they going to be motivated by $7,000? I don't think so.
Neither do I.
So it didn't work. It simply didn't work.
You know, it's interesting, Jeffrey, you're just making me think of the years we spent talking about one of the premises of the Senior Executive Service, which was that rank was supposed to reside in the person,
right,
not the position. And it was almost inevitable that agencies kept moving to the rank and position view. And that, again, inhibits putting people where they might, in fact, be best needed. But another thing I think we'd say about the 2004 legislation and the new pay system is no matter how wonderfully well you perform, in the end, all performance awards, all pay adjustments are discretionary with the agency. And there's no way, obviously, to require them. But the fact is that the system has not worked well for a wide variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. And most recently, we surveyed our members, and there were folks who 4 and 5 months after the rating year had ended had not yet received their ratings. Decisions had not been made on performance awards. The system is not very transparent in many agencies. It just goes on and on.
Yeah. And, you know, pay for performance wasn't only hitting the SCS at the time, because everybody remembers NSPS.
NSPS.
And which was the general schedule, and it was at DOD. And, you know, it was a colossal failure for so many reasons. But at the time, I feel vindicated, but I shouldn't be happy about this. I remember at the time saying, having a volley with Bill Bransford, who, you know, everybody knows who Bill was. And I'm not going to talk more about him because then I start to, you know, get weepy. But I remember having over time a volley with him, like, it's just not enough money. The government salary and award, even pre-sequestration, before Congress that doesn't value federal service and felt that they were some, you know, this, you know, smack around toy of the day. There just isn't enough money to incentivize, which was, Jeff, your point, in the general schedule and in the SES, there just isn't enough money to hand out to incentivize that kind of performance. And that's not why, when you look at surveys about why federal workers go to work, they don't go to work in the federal government because of pay. And the $1,200 bonus you're going to give them, even in the general schedule, is not an incentive for why they come to work. They come to work to serve.
Well, and SCA did a survey on that in 2009. We surveyed 14s and 15s in the government, and pay was not the top reason. It was they went into the SCS for pride. They served for the ability to do something great. You know, there were all these reasons. It could be a demotivator.
Right. And I wanted to point that out. That, Jeffrey, was the 120,000 bottom of the scale. It's absurd. You know, we all know, we've all talked to senior executives who are demoralized because they make less than the staff they supervise. And the staff knows it.
That is a problem. The whole pay issue is a problem. The lack of enough money in the system to really be an incentive is a problem. The other problem that's a huge one, and just what they call it, telegraphs what the problem is. Pay for performance. What comes first? Pay. Performance comes second. I did a whole series of blog posts on the problems with the performance appraisal processes in the government. They are atrocious. Nobody likes them. Unions don't like them. Managers don't like them. Political appointees don't like them.
The HR offices.
HR offices
find
them
cumbersome.
EEO offices don't like them. Rank and file employees don't like them. So nobody likes them. And so what we have is these totally flawed performance appraisal processes. So what do? We say, hey, we're going to base pay on performance. Yet we have a flawed performance appraisal process. It's like saying, here, I'll give you a glass of water, but there are holes all over the glass, so it's not going to work. I mean,
you're not going to get much out of it.
Yeah, if you're going to do pay for performance, and in theory, pay for performance could work. If you're going to do pay for performance, you have to have a tested, validated performance appraisal process where you can show that, yes, somebody who comes out of this process with a good rating is actually contributing more. Right, now, we don't have that.
It's not really even the royal we, it's the government. OPM agencies have spent so much time, OMB, on, I don't want to say perfecting, because they've hardly perfected the SES performance management system, but on trying to refine it and make it more results-driven and more detailed and more difficult. We've now got a system with 500 points, mm-hmm. in which you have to get 475 to be rated outstanding. And as you say, no one knows, does this make sense? Does it really measure what we want to measure? Does all the time and effort and energy that goes into it, is all that worth it?
Right. And if you've ever read a senior executive's, in today's government, performance plan and then rating, it's about 15 or 20 pages long, and I always feel like you need a PhD in HR sciences to understand what they're measuring, what the performance was, and how you got to that objective. It is so highly intellectualized.
It is not HR and it's not science. It's more like voodoo. And it's a ridiculous process. Think about this process. The process is entirely based on somebody looking at you as an SES and saying, okay, here is what I think you did, and judging you. And it's not looking forward, it's looking back. It's not looking at what the organization did, the organization I control. It's not looking at what my organization did for you working for me. It's looking at what you did. So we assume that the performance of the SES occurs in a vacuum, that there is no agency surrounding them, that there was no budget surrounding them, there were no other executives surrounding them. So we look at it in a very narrow way and look in a rearview mirror.
Yeah.
And then we expect that to drive performance going forward. And it doesn't. It simply doesn't. It's a bad process.
Well, and I think there are a couple other issues. As I've started looking into the pay for performance, because this certainly comes up in Congress, so I've been looking at quite a bit. Even in the private sector, which is where this came from in 2004, it was, let's model this after the private sector. Nobody ever had that conversation of, can government be the private sector? You don't measure performance in the same way. There's not widgets. There's not stakeholders.
There's not bottom lines.
And in the private sector, you don't have political bosses called Congress who change over, who affect things. They affect budgets. They affect what programs you can do. And so, to your point, Jeff, it's not a vacuum that they're doing performances. There are elements that you can and can't control. And so, so it's that question of, does pay for performance in the way they thought about it in the Bush administration, modeling it after the private sector, can you just fit that onto the government?
Well, I'm not even certain it was modeled after the private sector in a sense, because when you read business literature these days, there's an awful lot that suggests that business is seeing that the whole performance appraisal process is not effective. Nobody likes it. It doesn't go well. There are probably some better ways to do it. So.
And the other thing you have to look at when you're looking at these types of things is that we really don't know what good performance looks like sometimes in government. You're not looking at a profit motive.
Right.
You can't look at a bottom line.
What are
line.
We measuring? In the private sector, in most private sector organizations, you're measuring one of three things, as Jenny said. You're measuring the quality of the widget that was produced. Did GM produce a series of cars this year off of that line that didn't have a defect or a recall? You're measuring, if you're in a service industry, you're measuring the delivery, the quality of the delivery of customer service. Many federal employees go to work and don't deliver customer service. Their job doesn't require it. Or if you're in one part of the sector of our economy, you're measuring purely profit and bottom line.
And so if I'm in government and I'm writing policy, you could measure the effect of my policy. If I'm writing a policy that's designed to result in clean air, you could measure that. But it's going to take 5 years or 10 years to see what's happening with it. It's not something where I could write the regulation and then 3 months later, because it happens to be the end of my rating cycle, you can give me an evaluation that says, okay, Jeff, did the regulation help improve the environment? You simply can't do that with the type of work that's being done in government.
Right.
So it just doesn't work.
Right.
And also, the other thing that I think is really critical is that if you look at the private sector, I can tell you our board of directors is not going to have a discussion about an issue and then half of them walk out on the steps and badmouth the company. And that's what happens in government all the time. The half of the board of directors is badmouthing the company all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You can't run a good organization
and
that
the way. CEO doesn't very often, rare occasions, praise federal employees or defend them.
Yeah, and I've said this during, whatever it was 3 years ago, whatever it was during the, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years without, passing a budget. I had the pleasure of being on Francis Rose's Friday show where you have to pick the top news story of the week. And it was like every time I was on, I felt like the top news story of the week is Congress doesn't pass a budget again. And if you look constitutionally at their single most important job, right? So it's critical element one for a member of Congress, it's appropriations. And and no one's ever said how much they make. Jenny, you always know how much they make.
174.
Out of the conversation about senior executives and the executive branch make too much money and don't do anything, because we're going to get to that in part two of our show. No one, the conversation, you know, you can't get that conversation shifted to, and what are you doing for $174,000? But without a budget, you're running the single largest employer in the world. And that is lost on the American public. 1.9 million people go to work every day to run the executive branch, and the services and policies and ideas and things that come out of the executive branch. And how do you do that, as Jeffrey says? He says it as a board of directors. How do you do it if you're going to call it a corporation and everybody wants to run it that way? How do you do it when the corporate officers aren't doing their job? And that doesn't get measured. And I want to talk about that because that's my segue into the scandals that have produced these reform proposals that we're going to talk about in the second half. But you've written a blog about that. They've done a very nice job separating out the policy failures and the political failures from implementation problems in the executive branch. That's the second part of our show. This is our mid-show break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
If you're a federal manager, you deal with a lot of information. Here's a tip on breaking through the noise. Join the Federal Managers Association to have a voice on Capitol Hill. And to get filtered news and information specific to managing your workforce, join the 50,000 other federal managers who already subscribe and read the free weekly e-report, fedmanager.com. I'm Todd Wells, Executive Director of the Federal Managers Association, and I approve this message.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, and I'm hosting this morning's show. We're here talking about the state of the senior executive service and proposed reform legislation and how it will affect the state of the SES. And so, Carol, to bring us into that, because we did talk about the first part of the show, we talked about where the SES came from and the 2004 reform and what that's left us. But to move into the second part of our show, Carol, why don't you explain, you know, what is important about the S? What is the senior executive service supposed to do? And how is that translated into making them, you know, an excellent political target?
Well, I'm not sure I know how that translates, frankly, because it doesn't make sense. But in any event, well, they are. There are almost 7,000 senior executives, as I suspect much of your audience knows, and they do such a wide variety of jobs across government. So it can be jobs like the deputy CHECO, not the CHECO, which although some of them are career executives, most typically what you have in CFO, CIO jobs are political appointees. The deputy is a career. So it's a wide variety of jobs and huge responsibilities. I think many of them have responsibilities comparable to what they'd have in a Fortune 500 company. They are obviously there to make the career political team successful. And so what we hope is that political appointees see them as the essential partners. They're obviously critical during times of transition. Institutional memory is important. They can help get things done. They have day-to-day management responsibilities. So what makes them such good targets? You know, this is one that I've really been trying to understand myself, because logically speaking, as one reporter asked me, why aren't they focusing on the political leadership? Where have they gone? Well, I think career SES are easy targets because they are in a very difficult position. I mean, they're not the ones who typically are going to be before the Congress trying to defend their agencies, but and they're certainly not the ones who are very often permitted to talk to the media. So one would think that they would be somewhat insulated, but they're not. And I think what we've seen is a couple of alleged scandals where there was a convenient poster child, one of them, unfortunately, with the same name as your other guest, Jeffrey, who had the poor judgment to post a personal picture on social media. Those few situations have provided a media firestorm, which has been seized upon by members of Congress. This is an election year. It's a way for them to get traction with the public. And most particularly, if you look at VA, where everyone is concerned about the wounded warrior, about providing veterans the best services, et cetera, it's so interesting that the focus has turned to a number of people who, by the way, have not yet been proven to be guilty of what they've been accused of, but and turned away from Congress and any question of how the VA budget requests were being handled, or in fact political leadership, which was ignoring IG reports that made recommendations. I mean, it's just become an amazing thing to watch. I mean, that whether it's, you know, the SES indeed as a convenient pinata, you know, so that if you take any one piece of the SES system and hold it up, whether, if, for example, pay, you know, and the average American might be earning $35,000-$40,000 and say, my God, these people are earning $170,000 without regard to their responsibilities, of course, because we don't get into that. So it's really been an ugly scene to watch, and it's very dangerous right now.
Yeah, it is very dangerous. Jeffrey?
Well, I think the reason the SES is the piñata is proximity. You know, there's this concept you hear a lot in DOD about proximity to the flagpole. And the closer you are to the senior leadership of the organization, the more access you have, the more influence you have, and the more vulnerable you are.
Yeah, I think Jerry Shaw called that the shadow of the flag, under the shadow of the flag.
And so what happens is on the plus side, the people who are very close to the flagpole tend to be viewed more favorably in a lot of cases. They get better performance ratings, they get bigger bonuses. One of the things DOD found in NSPS is that people who were close to the flagpole got bigger bonuses, and people who were farther away didn't. They got better performance ratings. People who were farther away didn't. But what that cuts both ways. And what happens is when there's a problem and someone at the top is looking for somebody to shoot, they look at who's close by.
Right.
And one of those people tends to be the one to get the blame. The problem you run into is that responsibility for problems, particularly when you've got things that like at VA that may be cultural issues within the agency, there are more than one person responsible for that. There is usually a lot of people responsible for it, and you have to look at what's creating the problem, not find the symptoms of the problem and go remove those. That doesn't solve the problem. If the system is generating this kind of behavior, and you remove the people who are behaving badly, the system will just generate more people who behave badly. So you have to fix the system first.
Right. And that assumes that, as Carol pointed out, this is all alleged, that they were intentionally acting in their own personal interest. But you wrote, Jeff, you wrote a June 25th blog post called You're Fired, which you know, I would encourage every one of our listeners to go read, because you make that very point that when you read all of the independent reports coming, I'm going to apply your blog post to the VA scandal in quotes. When you read all of these independent reports that discuss these problems with access to service, these reports that have been going on for over 5 years, it's clear it's systemic. So usually in big organizations, one person down the chain, and these senior executives are very far down the chain, because you got to start at the secretary level and all of the politicals, you know, between the secretary and a medical center director, and there are a lot of them, that when you get to, you know, one person you found for the, you know, who you want to blame in an organization like that, when you know the problems are systemic, it's just a convenience. And you make that point in your blog post. But we have gone down that rabbit hole in Congress, Jenny. You know, you're up there. You've been up there now for 8 weeks. They are very deep down the rabbit hole and declaring that the problem in many organizations is the career senior executives. And so we have a whole host of legislation now being proposed.
Let me just say one thing before Jenny goes into that I think is really very frustrating, and that is the amount of misinformation mm-hmm. out there. And it's misinformation that the Congress, for whatever reason, has focused on or doesn't understand or refuses to understand. And it's the media, too. I listened to NPR one evening driving home, and hear a commentator saying that all employees at VA are members of union. And I thought, that's going to be news to a whole lot of senior executives there. So it has become just this perfect storm, and which has led now to the dangerous legislation mm-hmm. that Jenny's going to talk about.
Well, and Carol actually makes the point that I was just going to make, too, is that, and sort of wrote this down while everybody was talking, is that nobody up there knows who federal employees are. It's yeah. not just senior executives. They don't typically, and I shouldn't say no one, because there are some former federal employees working up there, but they don't know what they do, the differences in levels. And, you know, I even find that in the federal service. If you ask a GS-5 what a senior executive does, you know, they don't interact a lot. And so there's water cooler myths and things like that around the service that you find as well. And
right,
so,
a lot of myths. Mm-hmm. Jenny comes across this when she's up on the Hill dealing with members of Congress and their staff. There's a lot of myth that something has happened that is now accepted as fact. And when Secretary Shinseki and the president both said, when this quote-unquote scandal broke, said, you know, we want to wait, you know, we got investigators, and we want to wait for, you know, a report with facts, they were really criticized. Jenny and I had that conversation. It was sort of a sad day in our democracy, that that getting to the truth, we didn't have the patience to wait, to collect the information, to get to the truth. It was like, you're guilty now because somebody says you are.
Well, the other
terrible one is that it's the other awful myth is that it's hard to fire a senior executive. That's the one that's just astonishing.
Part of the problem with this is a big part of the problem with this is that fixing the real problems is hard. Mm-hmm. And we've already seen the negotiations mm-hmm. between the House and the Senate on what to do about VA.
Yeah, the omnibus.
Break down.
Yeah.
They've sort of broken down over money, which I guess means you can go to war on a credit card, but you can't take care of your veterans on the same credit card. I would think, given how many veterans we've produced over the last dozen years or so, that we would be doing everything we can to make certain that we fulfill our obligations to those veterans, since they fulfilled their service to us. But it's hard to fix the problems. It's easy to try to find a scapegoat and to try to find somebody's head who can roll and put the head on the stick and say, look at that, we solved this problem because we fired Betty Lou.
Right.
When Betty Lou's not really the problem, she's the symptom. But writing good legislation and writing good public policy is hard work, and it requires a lot of thought and it requires compromise, and it requires people who are willing to look very deeply into issues and not just react.
Yeah, and Jenny's up against that on the Hill all the time.
Well, and there's, and what we're seeing with the federal government play out right now in the federal workforce is really sort of a microcosm of the problems. You can read a whole bunch of different articles that talk about the amount of time that Congress is in town. Nobody lives here, so they aren't colleagues anymore. They're out campaigning most of the time, and so the ability to actually work on these comprehensive, there isn't the level of professional staff on the Hill. I mean, there are all these intractable problems with how the legislative branch is working that the federal employee has become sort of it because they have direct control over federal workforce. And so that's become a convenient scapegoat. And on the SES side, we're in an election year. Populism always reigns. It's easy to go that. And so where do you go? You go after the word executive. Mm-hmm. And they've done that, whether it's Wall Street, whether it's other things. It's easy. And I always talk about it, too, to Jeff's point about being difficult to tackle these. If you can't talk about it in 140 characters, you're not going to talk about it.
That's what we've become.
And so it's too simple to say they don't understand or they don't know the real, because there are a lot of people who up there who understand these issues and know what they're saying maybe not is not exactly right, but they feel political pressure to go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, and we have to take our final break, Jenny. When we come back, I want you to tick off the legislative proposals that are pending so that our listeners can understand what this rabbit hole really looks like. This is our last, our final commercial break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting today's show on the Senior Executive Service and possible upcoming reforms. And with us to give us a brief on what reforms are out there now pending on Capitol Hill before next, Thursday when they go out for their August recess, which is otherwise called a vacation. Jenny Mattingly, who is the Legislative Director for the Senior Executive Association.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's funny, about a year ago, we'd been in about 3 years of anti-federal employee legislation. It was kind of funny. And then last summer at this time, it all of a sudden veered off the rails and went after senior executives. That's about last summer, right before they went on August recess, was when they decided to focus on the SES. And that was after the GSA scandal that really kicked it off. And Congress passed a bill to allow agency heads to place senior executives on unpaid investigative leave, as they called it, and to allow agency heads to fire senior executives. That was really the kickoff of this at-will thing, and that's become one of the biggest proposals that's floating around. Now, with the VA, it sort of has fed on itself, is to allow agency heads, political appointees, to decide who and when they should keep their jobs or leave their jobs. A couple other things that are out there that aren't getting as much talk, but there is a persistent undercurrent to ban SES performance awards. So it goes back to what we were talking about. If you're not paying for performance, do you have pay for performance? You really can't. And now talk to rescind performance awards, downgrade ratings. There are all these amendments that nobody's talking about to add conduct into performance. This idea that all these people must not be having good conduct, and so we need to ding their performance awards based off tax delinquency, other things. And there's still some legislation, like the one you mentioned, Deborah, too, that passed the markup of the House Oversight and Government Reform that would sort of, it's on its face, it looks like it's easing the way to fire senior executives within they've picked up the idea that they need to keep due process in there. And so they're looking for some sort of framework where they think they're giving more tools to mm-hmm. agencies. But to Carol's point, as we keep saying, the tools are there. So it's just sort of this way of this idea that every senior executive must be a poor performer, so we've got to find a way to get them out. And that's the undercurrent that's running through Congress right now.
Right. How do we fire them quicker and easier?
Well, if you want better executives, do you want to create a system where you say to those people that you want to be federal executives, we want you to be at-will employees. We want you to not be able to get a bonus because somebody else messed up. And since somebody else messed up, the entire organization must be tainted. So we're not going to give you anything
right,
either.
Right. The proposal now is all of IRS and all of VA. It's a proposal. We'll see what the Senate does with it. That they would not be eligible, right, Carol, for performance for all of 2015 or 2014.
Yeah. And some of them are multi-year bans, actually.
Speaking of the IRS, you mentioned the tax delinquency mm-hmm. issue. Just to get on the record, the tax delinquency rate for federal employees is about a third that of the tax delinquency rate for the general public.
I know.
And it's also significantly less than employees of the House of Representatives.
Yeah. Yep.
So we just need to mention that.
No, there was a study on that a few months ago, and federal employees, number one, but most importantly, federal employees in the IRS were the best at filing the returns and paying their taxes. Best of all Americans.
You know, I want to talk about this legislation that Jenny's been describing, because there are a couple of important points to make. One is that what started as taking whacks at the IRS or the VA has now morphed to government-wide SES legislation. And so if there are senior executives out there who think, I'm doing a good job, my agency's doing fine, none of this is going to affect me, they better think twice, because at some point the Congress will have their agency in its crosshairs.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the kinds of pieces of legislation that are being considered, not looking at this as a system. They are bits and pieces taking whacks at it here and there, and when they get through, it can be a crazy quilt that will make little sense. And finally, you know, it really is easy to fire senior executives. We all know that. And there is, however, some semblance of due process. And the real danger to these at-will bills is it can really take us to very easily a situation where the core can be politicized.
Yeah, and I know Jeffrey wrote a whole blog and wants to jump in, but I want to say this one thing. What these little, they're not little, but what these whacks are, these legislative proposed whacks are, it's going to create, Carol, you say a quilt work, but it's really going to create a quilt work of punitive. It's going to become just a system of punishment. And if you already were having trouble getting people to join the SES because of pay compression, why would anyone join it now? You talk to people out there. I do. I talk to a lot of people. And it's career senior executives in the government. Why would anyone go to the VA?
Nobody would. I mean, if you look at the bill that passed the House to allow the secretary to fire SES members, what it said was just breathtaking. It said, notwithstanding any other provision of law, the secretary could fire people. And I've seen that language before. We had it at TSA in the Aviation and Transportation Security Act. It has been shown in court time after time to mean exactly what it says. So that means if the secretary says, I'm going to get rid of you because you have blue eyes,
mm-hmm.
he could do it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get rid of you
because you blew the whistle on me.
I'm going to get rid of you because you blew the whistle. I'm going to get rid of you because you were appointed by the Bush administration. I'm going to get rid of you because you were appointed by the Obama administration. Notwithstanding any other provision of law,
I'm going to
exactly
get rid of you because you're a single parent. You're an unmarried mother.
And some people say, well,
you're too old.
We have laws against discrimination.
Notwithstanding.
Not when you say notwithstanding any other provision of law.
Right.
And I have a longtime friend who is a union executive, and she said something about this most recent SES proposal and say, I finally agree with the other party because she's a Democrat. And I sent her a note back and I said, be careful what you wish for, because if this passes for senior executives, then the precedent has been set, and then it will apply to the rest of the civil service. And what we will find is a civil service that very slowly or maybe quickly starts returning to a spoils system. Mm-hmm. And I would encourage people to look at the history of the Pendleton Act and what the spoils system was doing to this country and why we have a career civil service. If we aren't careful, we're going to end up going back to a political spoils system. And we've seen how well politics works on the Hill. Let's just put in the entire executive branch.
Yeah. Carol, what's SEA doing? What are all the things SEA is doing to try to create, you know, to push back?
Well, obviously, we've been working nonstop on the Hill, meeting with staff, meeting with members, writing letters, talking to the media, trying to educate them, because that's so critical. Again, you can read two articles in the Washington Post on the same day about what's transpiring on the Hill and see two different versions of, for example, the state of the VA investigation. So it's mind-boggling. But this has just been nonstop for us, and we have some other ideas that we're pursuing because I think there need to be some influential people in this country who start weighing in before we become a banana republic. So the other thing that we're doing is really encouraging senior executives to join the association.
Why is that important?
Well, we're like public television. You know, you can watch and you don't have to contribute. They get the benefit of our work without being members, but it is critical that we have more members mm-hmm. because they provide the resources to enable us to do our work. Mm-hmm. And frankly, there are members of Congress and others who say, well, how many executives are members? Because they view that as, do they care?
That's right.
So I urge senior executives to join SEA. Our website is senior execs, that's plural, SENIOREXECS.org.
Yeah. And for those, and you know, Carol and I, and I know Jenny, we run into this often talking to senior executives who aren't at the VA or the IRS. And they're, you know, they really seem, some, not all, seem a bit disconnected that. That what's happening, the congressional reforms being proposed, and I don't even like the word reform, but the congressional legislative penalties being proposed for VA and IRS, and Jenny knows this, and I want Jenny in the last 2 minutes to give us an idea of where all this might go, this session of Congress and next. It's, you know, you're one heartbeat away in this town from it being SES-wide. And I know, Carol, you made that point. So people should care across government. I think unions should care.
Well, and I was just going to say, I don't think it's SES-wide. And, you know, we've talked about this just a few minutes ago. This is coming. There are people who have been looking for ways to make it easy to fire federal employees for years. And so you get a foot in the door and show that it's going to be passed into law. And this is going to be coming down the track. And so there are some groups that both union and other federal employee associations that are watching this pretty closely. But I think for the average folk, a lot of times you think Congress doesn't get anything done. They're not going to pass bills.
And there's
not,
all these problems, you know, at VA. So why right. not have this fix at the VA?
Right. And it really will go. I think that what we're starting to see with this bill that Oversight and Government Reform did yesterday, it's starting to expand, you know, and each time it's going to go a little farther. You know, it's hard to put a bet on where Congress is going to go because who knows? I don't even think they know right now.
They got 5 days left, right?
Right. Well, not even 5 days, really. They'll be out by Thursday evening for their August recess. VA legislation may pass by next week with some form of the firing provision in it. The rest of this stuff, we're probably going to be looking at not much activity until the elections. And then after that, if you've got a lame duck Congress, watch out, especially, it depends. If the Senate changes over to being Republican controlled instead of Democrat and they hold both chambers, they're going to pass some of this federal employee legislation through.
So for me, what that means is I'm probably going to see you all back here in this chamber talking about what's happened after, what can we expect, where is Congress after the midterm election, because it looks, looks in the House like it could go entirely Republican, which would be, you know, would be a bad day for the civil service. I don't want to say for federal employees, be a bad day for the merit system and the American democracy. Carol Bonacero, Jeffrey Neal, Jenny Mattingly, thank you very much for joining me this morning.